Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, biz is spelled B-I-Z. Please use this address as we're to start a mailing list, which will then keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes and much more. The address again is ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who in the 70s almost achieved the big time as a drummer in a pop band with a single released and Radio 1 DJs in attendance at the launch. I first met Dave when we were colleagues in an insurance company. We were both training officers. We would often go for a prayer walk in 1993 as I had a decision to make about my future, especially as God had told me to apply for redundancy. I eventually ended up at United Christian Broadcasters. And Dave once phoned in as a listener. This was around 1995. Like in most people's lives, people come and people go. But I've often wondered whatever happened to my prayer partner. A couple of years ago, Google suggested there was a Dave Carson, but this person had lost both his legs because of sepsis. So what is sepsis? What is myeloma? And what was it like to be a patient with myeloma as well as sepsis? What was his faith like at the time? And where is his faith now? Does he blame God? Has he any regrets about not becoming a pop star? All these questions, it gives me great pleasure to welcome and reacquaint myself with my old colleague. I'm assuming it's the same Dave Carson. And welcome to Off-Grid Christianity. Dave Carson, Dave, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to see you for the first time, actually, in about 30 years. I know we've talked over the phone a couple of times in the past year or so, but it's great to actually see you. So thank you very much indeed. Where are we speaking to you from, good sir?
Well, I'm in Kettering now, Martin, in Northamptonshire. It's maybe about 70 miles north of London.
Yes.
And it's a reasonable sized town. I don't know how many thousand people are here, but it's a reasonable sized town. And we've been here for about 7 years.
You've got the Kettering accent as well, of course.
I'm glad you noticed that. Aye.
So for those that's trying to say, that's not a Northamptonshire accent, where are you from originally?
Well, I'm originally from a place called Dalkeith, which is about 7 miles south of Edinburgh.
Hence the Scottish twang.
That's right.
Yeah. You haven't lost it at all, which is great.
Yeah.
Loads to talk about. So if you're sitting comfortably, let's go for the five alternative questions so we can know a bit more about you, or maybe not. Sure. Question number one, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask him questions, who would it be?
Well, it was a really interesting question, Martin, and I had no doubt about the area I would be looking at, because although I haven't played drums for maybe 5 or 6 years,
yes,
I'm still interested in drumming, and I'm reading a lot about drummers, and on Facebook there's loads of people post their drumming, and I listen to it, and some are well-known, some are not so well-known. I started to look at the evolution, if you like, of the drum kit.
Yes.
And I came across a guy called Papa Joe Jones. He was born in 1911.
Okay.
He was known as a pioneer of jazz percussion.
Right.
I thought, wow, this would be great, because he played in the Count Basie Orchestra as well.
Oh.
And he travelled with them. So I thought, this would be a great guy to sit down with a cup of tea or something and chat. You know, what was it like to introduce new pieces of equipment to the drum kit? Because the drum kit, going back, you just saw an enormous big bass drum in front of the drummer, a snare drum, and maybe a cymbal dangling somewhere.
Yes.
But he introduced different things like skulls, wood blocks, and different cymbals and different sounding drums. And I'd like to have known, what was it like to do that? You know, because that was the kind of standard kit at one time. Now you're introducing other things. What did that feel like? What were people thinking, you know? Also, what was it like on the road? You know, travelling in a bus.
Yes.
Night after night with these famous people, Count Basie. And at the time, they were still well known. And backing people like Frank Sinatra. I thought, what was that like? You know, when Frank hands over the dots to someone and says, it's in the key of such and such. And you've got to play along and make sure it's right.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, what was that like? What was that life really like? So that intrigued me for a while. you know, this character, Papa Joe Jones.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the racism that was so prevalent in those days, especially.
Yes. And I actually wondered about that. I never, in my head, when I was thinking about this conversation, I didn't cross that line and ask that question about racism. I didn't go near there at all. For some reason, maybe rightly or wrongly, Martin, I just thought, well, if there's entertainers coming along, it's fine. It's okay. They're on stage, we're paying to listen to hear them. So I didn't cross that with them, but in my conversation, you know, in my mind, I didn't explore that at all.
Yeah.
I just saw the picture of the guy and thought, well, just let's go for a conversation with this guy.
Yeah.
Racism actually didn't come into it, really. I never thought about it.
Yeah. Well, when you do meet him then, if we could arrange it, please ask him, because, you know, the North-South divide in America.
Yeah.
It was horrendous what was going on there, basically. Yeah. And Count Basie could most probably go and walk into any hotel, New York-wise, and people would let him in. But if he went down south, it doesn't matter who, how famous he is.
Yeah. Yes.
What would have happened? So, yes, I would like to know.
Yeah.
Right. Let me know what the answers are. Meanwhile, question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, David?
I didn't really have to think much about this, Martin, because it was more to do with the place that these things happened in.
Mm-hmm.
The story of the parables, one about Jesus when disciples were sleeping, you know, there was a storm brewing and he calmed the storm. And the other one was when they weren't catching any fish. And he says, well, throw the nets in this side.
Yes.
And they caught all these fish. Now, all that happened in the Sea of Galilee. And for as long as I can remember, Martin, the name Sea of Galilee, there was something conjured up in my mind about that. Even the word Galilee, it sounded lovely.
Mm.
I've actually been there twice. Well, the first time we went there on a cruise, We went on a day trip from the bus.
I was going to say, I couldn't see. I was wondering how the cruise line
had got ship went up Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, which is a landlocked sea. It's like, that'd be very interesting to get from the Med. How did they do that? Yeah.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? That'd be quite a sight, definitely. The coach drove past the Sea of Galilee and the guy said, well, that's, it's over there. And I could just glimpse it. I thought, oh, Sea of Galilee. Wish we could stop. And at that time, I had both legs, and I'd always thought if we stopped there, I would wade in to the Sea of Galilee. Anyway, the second cruise we went on, we did another coach trip. And this time, this coach pulled into a restaurant. It was on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. I couldn't believe it.
Mm.
Of course, I had prosthetics legs then. But we were sitting having a meal, and the sea was just a few yards away. So I walked down to the edge of the Sea of Galilee, and there's notices there saying no diving, no swimming, etc. And people were running past, diving in. So I couldn't go in. I think Margaret waded in a wee bit. But what I did was I wandered up and I found a sort of quiet bit, and I put both my hands in the water, you know, palm down.
Yeah.
And I could feel the cold water going up my wrists. And I thought, wow, this is the Sea of Galilee. Extraordinary. You know, to think that these stories that are there in the Bible, this is where it happened.
Yes.
Okay, it might have been a few miles away down the sea a bit, but it was just fascinating. And we also went to a place at which they reckon the Beatitudes were read. And of course, the Sea of Galilee, again, is in the background. And that is such a beautiful, calm spot. It really is. So, as I say, The parable, yes, they happened there, but it was really the place, the Sea of Galilee. And to have been there and put my hands in the water, wow, it was incredible. Incredible.
I'm going to let you have that because a couple of weeks ago, somebody chose Balaam's ass as his favourite character. So,
all right, yeah.
I'm going to let you have that as well, Sea of Galilee.
Oh, thank you.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant answer. And the fact you were able to put your hands in the water and feel it.
Oh, yeah, I know. Oh, tremendous.
Question three, I wonder where this is going to end up. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, young Dave?
Well, that came quite easily, Martin, because when I became disabled, you know, there's something called the personal independence payment, which is half disability and half mobility. So I was getting that. Margaret was still working at the time, although she had to give up work. because of the stress and everything happened, and I'd lost my job. When Margaret got her estate pension, this carer's allowance, mm-hmm. which she was getting, stopped.
Yes.
It just stops. It's as if I'm fine now. You know, there's a lot less money coming in, but this thing that was necessary, it just stopped. And there's been so many people on Facebook that have talked about this. And I thought, it's just, what does it say I've suddenly become okay and I don't need help or assistance in any way? So I think I would change that right away. I don't say I would backdate it, but that'd be too much. You know, when I think the position we were in then,
yeah.
and it was only 200 odd pounds, Martin, but that was a lot, you know, and that is an awful lot for a lot of people. You know, that's, it just didn't seem right to us. I couldn't see the sense in it, Martin, put it that way. So that's what I would do.
No, I'm reliant on carers allowance because, as you know, I look after my very ill wife at the moment. Yes, fully support that. Thank you. Get that through. Let me know how you get on.
Yeah.
Question 4. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out so far, please, Dave?
It was difficult to pick one, Martin, but there's two that were just incredible, really. So I'll tell you the two of them, if it's okay. Margaret and I went on holiday to Greece. This has gone way back, 1982. And we're staying in a hotel on the coast, just a few miles from Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of days, we got chatting to this guy. And he was asking us about ourselves and what we're doing on holiday. And I said, what do you do? He says, oh, I'm a journalist and a reporter. I said, oh, that's really interesting. What are you here for? He says, well, have you not heard of the European Games? I said, no, not really. European Games, no. So I suppose if I'd been at home watching the television, I would have seen bits and pieces. Oh, he says, you'll need to come to the European Games. And maybe the look on my face thought, well, you know, it's going to be a bit expensive, maybe getting there. He says, I tell you what, come with me tomorrow to the Games. I thought, well, that's great. So Margaret and I gets into this coach, and there were athletes in the coach. This guy came from Holland. So there was athletes on the coach and him and other, what he introduces, other reporters. So we drove to Athens. We drove to the stadium. He took us into the stadium. There was nothing to pay. He took us up the staircases where all the cameras were, and there was a space where he sat. And he says, you two can sit there. Fine. And we sat there and we watched all this, and I thought, this is unbelievable. And that night, there was 5 world records broken, and the place erupted.
What year was this again?
1982.
Oh, COVID.
It might have been, yeah. But we also saw Daley Thompson winning his gold.
Oh,
I'm looking at Martin, she's looking at me, is this really happening? You know, we just arrived here. And Daley Thompson's there at the end of the night with the Union Jack. Oh, Martin, it was just, I've never, ever forgotten that. It's just been there, you know, in my memory. It's just incredible, incredible time, really was. And it just happened. You know, we weren't looking for it. What do you think of that?
I think that's a brilliant story. I'm getting rid of the fact that a Scotsman mentioned the word Union and Jack in the same sentence as well. That's...
I know. You can edit that out.
No, I'm keeping that in.
So the other one was, I don't think it was too long after that. I can't remember the exact date. But Margaret and I were in Florida for a holiday. And we went to the Epcot Center, I think that's right.
Epcot, yeah.
And it's in a kind of big circle. There's all sorts of maybe hotels, restaurants and that sort of thing all round about it. And then there's a large seating area. And then there's a stage and a little dome above it. It was, for all the world, like a kind of mini Hollywood Bowl, if you like.
Yes.
You know, Margaret and I were around these different places and we were sampling food, one from Italy, one from Germany, one from this. And then we wandered back to the back of the seating area and there was an A-board, just a simple A-board, sitting outside this restaurant. And it said, Beach Boys here at 1 o'clock. So anyway... I sees this waiter and I said, look, this A sign, Beach Boys here at 1 o'clock. I says, is this a tribute act or so? He said, no, it's the Beach Boys. It tells you it's the Beach Boys. I says to Margaret, it says the Beach Boys appearing here at 1 o'clock. I can't believe it. People started filling up the seats. And I thought, well, we've not got a seat, but we'll just stand here because the stage is right in front of us. We can see everything, but it can't be the Beach Boys. So we're standing and places filling up and chattering and laughing and all the rest of it. And Margaret says, yeah, that's a helicopter. I said, what? So it is. I couldn't see it. And then it stopped. And then in the corner, just way at the side of the stage, these guys started walking in and went up on the stage with the floral shirts and all the rest of it. I'm looking. So who's the singer? Mike Love.
It was Mike Love.
He's standing there. And then there was another two originals there as well. Mm-hmm. He introduced them, and I couldn't remember the names, Martin. I was almost shaking. I said, this is the Beach Boys. This is incredible. You know, anyway, they started. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, Martin. I could not hardly believe it. You close your eyes, you were listening to a record. The harmonies, Everything was just fantastic. And I had a young drummer on, a youngish looking guy. Oh, the sound, you know, and when they started, the good vibrations, you know, I thought, whoa, what is this? You know, oh, I was gone. And Margaret and I just looked at each other and thought, what's the chances of you seeing the Beach Boys these days? You turn up here for an afternoon out, you're outside a restaurant, and a neighbor says the Beach Boys are here at 1 o'clock. It was, Martin, it was an incredible concert.
That's fantastic.
I was absolutely speechless, really, listening to it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. Well, let's then link in from these two really enjoyable moments to what's been your most embarrassing moment then to date, please, Dave.
It came to my mind right away, Martin, and I wasn't sure if it was, well, it was embarrassing, but it was also a wee bit humiliating looking back on it.
Ooh.
It was the time where I was at school. I was probably about 13 or thereabouts. I was already playing in a band. The band was quite well known, really, locally. This gym teacher, it was dancing. You know, every now and again you got dancing. And so everybody's lined up and they play like a piece of music and you had to move across the floor. Oh, dear. Anyway, they played this tune and he says, okay, this is the bossa nova. So I thought, right, what an awful. So we all sort of wiggled our way across the room that was in the gymnasium, got to our side. I thought, thank goodness that's over. That was awful. And he says, Carson, call yourself a drummer, eh? Let's see you doing that again. And I thought, no, I'm not doing it. You know, no, I'm not doing this. He says, come on, let's see you doing the bossa nova. And I thought, right, I'll do it. I'll go across the floor as best I can here. And I did it. I was the only one on that floor, Martin, went across and came back. And the place was silent, you know. And I thought, initially, that was a real embarrassment.
Yeah.
And then I thought, there's a bit of, he's trying to humiliate me, this guy, for some reason. Because he knows I play in a band or whatever, and maybe I was more popular than him, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I still think about that moment. I sometimes wish I'd had the guts to say, look, why don't you give us a demonstration first, you know?
Absolutely.
Can you not just give me a demonstration? Just a few steps, you know?
Yeah, proper training, that is.
Exactly, yeah. And also I thought, because there was a few of my mates there, they said, oh, Dave, you know, I wish we had spoke up there. That was awful. And sometimes I wish we had just gone out of there, up to the headmaster's office and knocked on his door and explained what had happened. I hope it wouldn't happen now, Martin, because I think trying to humiliate someone like that is causing them embarrassment, wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I'm trying to work out what his raison d'etre was for doing that.
Yeah, I really don't know why he did that.
Well, thank you for sharing all those things, Dave. I don't want to harp on about what it was like when you and I worked together in a certain institution, because people be switching off in their droves. What I would like to talk about is what happened subsequently when you and I were no longer in communicado. And for me to find out from Google that it was the same Dave Carson, but first of all, he had sepsis and then myeloma. most people would be unaware of the thoughts of exactly what they are. They might have heard those terms.
Yeah.
No doubt you've shared this hundreds of times because you are an ambassador for the Sepsis Trust as well. Part of your testimony, no doubt, is about how you got it. But imagine you've never shared this story before. So please tell me what happened.
Yeah. Well, I think if I wasn't sharing my story before, the situation would be, Martin, it's happened I don't know how many times now and over the years, I would just walk onto a stage and stand up to a microphone and I'd look out and people are just staring at the legs or just my stumps. Well, I don't have artificial legs as such. It's just the socket and the pole you see in the feet. And there's always been a kind of silence and people have looked and I've got to break the silence. And I always start with, I'm one of the lucky ones. And I'm wondering what's going on in people's minds. And they may think, well, my goodness. And you've lost parts of your fingers as well. And you're one of the lucky ones. And I say, yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Because not many people survive this sepsis. And we know people that have lost both arms and both legs. And sadly and tragically, some people have lost their loved ones and they've lost maybe young children. So that's when I go into sepsis and what it is. And what sepsis is, Martin, is it's the body's overreaction to dealing with an infection. So anybody can get an infection anywhere on the body or inside the body. Normally, the immune system deals with it. Sometimes we don't even know we've got an infection somewhere, unless there's a pain or a rash or something. But the immune system deals with it. But for some reason, and we're not really sure yet, but it does happen, the immune system goes into overdrive. For a normal, like, say, a cut in your arm, something like that, it becomes inflamed, and that's a way of dealing with it. But for some reason, the body overreacts. And with that comes the fact that it destroys its own tissues and organs. And this can happen very, very quickly. People can die within 12 hours of noticing it. When this happened to me, I decided that, and Margaret decided, we would raise awareness to this. So what happened to me was I was doing some training down in Dunstable. Now, I was working for a drug and alcohol charity. I worked for them 2.5 days a week. They trained me up in drugs and alcohol, and it was such a worthwhile job, Martin. Rather than talking about skills, soft skills and products, I was talking about something that people could take away and help them to change somebody's life, you know? And I was trained as well in how to interview people in that process called motivational interviewing. So I loved it, absolutely loved it. So I was in Dunstable, finished the training with some of the council employees there, go back in the car, and I could feel my throat. I was getting a sore throat. And I thought, well, you know, I've been talking for a while, maybe it's that. But then I started to get a wee bit shivery and a wee bit achy. And I thought, oh, this might be the flu.
Absolutely.
So I drove home, and this was on Tuesday, I think it was. But prior to that, on the Monday, I had been in London. Now, for the past 10 years previous, I had worked with the City of London Police, because in 2003, I set up a mentoring program for them. So for 2.5 days a week, I was working with this drug and alcohol charity, training people in drug and alcohol awareness, or training them in how to talk with people that are going through this change from being addicted to being free. Then the rest of the time, I had my own business, which was some mentoring I did, some training and things I was studying at the time, hope, optimism, gratitude, savoring, that kind of thing. And I was really quite enjoying my life at that time. And on the Monday, before all this kicked off with me, I'd been in London and signed another contract with the City of London Police. And we discussed what was going to happen. And normally I would send them a program and they would write back and say, yeah, here's the dates. That's where I'd been. And I was always conscious, Martin, of being in London, touching things, handrails, door handles, that kind of thing, and being in spaces. I never gave much thought after that. You know, you're in a enclosed space like inside the tube. But after you get out, it you know, it's out of your mind, you're wondering where you're going to go next. On the Tuesday, I finished working there in Dunstable, and that's when I started to feel a bit like the flu. And Margaret was away in a conference, so I couldn't chat to her about it, and I just thought, oh, I'll be fine, you know, take hot drink and some paracetamol. Wednesday, I started to feel a bit worse, but I didn't have a cough or anything. I just felt under the weather. I think that's what I could say. So on the Thursday, I was in the office of the drug and alcohol charity in Northampton. And somebody said to me, Dave, you don't look well. And I said, well, I finished at 12:30 today, so I'll be fine. Now, when I got home, Martin, I looked in the mirror. And I say this at the talks. In Scotland, we have a word for if you're not looking too well, and it's peely-wally. You're looking a bit peely-wally. I looked in the mirror. I couldn't believe the colour of my face, Martin. It was whitish, greyish colour. I was starting to feel worse, but I would still say it was the flu.
Yes.
Really, the genuine flu. Margaret came home on a Friday, and I says to her, she said, well, just watch what you're doing, Dave. You know, just be careful. Just take it easy. Over the weekend, things were fine. I was still feeling poorly. But on Monday, the 8th of April, 2013, I started to feel really ill. And Margaret, if she said to me once, Martin, she said to me two or three times, I think we should call the surgery, Dave, and talk to a doctor, get the doctor to call, and just talk about how you're feeling about things.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, look, Margaret, I've got the flu. I know what they're going to tell me. Take some paracetamol, take a hot drink, go to your bed. And Margaret kept nagging me. Now, something really terrible happened, Martin, after that. I was violently sick, and I thought, this isn't flu. And at one point, I was lying on the floor, and I thought I was going to die. I mean, I genuinely thought, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
From my head to my toes, I could hardly move, and I felt a cold sweat on the back of my neck. I couldn't speak. I just lay there, and the thought that was going through my mind was, impending doom.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going to happen and it's too late. And I just lay there. I don't know how long I was like that, but then it was as if it was a wave that had gone over me. And I got up and I said to Margaret, you know, this has happened to me. I think best to call a surgery. Could you do it? So she called the surgery, and the surgeon had said to Margaret, well, look, we can't get anyone out to your husband, but we'll get a doctor to phone him. So I thought, well, that's fair enough, you know. Nowadays, of course, we would dial 111 and we'd just sort of take ourselves to A&E. But then we thought the first protocol is a surgery. So anyway, then the doctor called me later on in the evening, and just I tried to explain how I was feeling and what happened. And this is what the doctor said. She said, take some paracetamol, take a hot drink, rest, and come and see me in the morning at the surgery. So I thought, that's fine. So we normally have paracetamol and things like that in the house, but Margaret couldn't find any. So she went out. And once she came back, now, I can't remember anything of this, Martin. I'm just trying to explain what Margaret witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
Margaret saw me sitting at the top of the stairs. She stood open the door. I was at the top of the stairs, and she says I was confused and my speech was slurred. And she knew right away that was bad. And she just ran in and dialed 999. Now, somehow, I don't know how, I got downstairs and I just collapsed in the living room. And the first responder came. Then right at the back of that, the paramedics came and the big ambulance. And they had a look at me. Of course, I don't know anything about this. And Margaret thought that one of them said to the other like this, sepsis. You know, she couldn't really hear it. Anyway, I was taken in, rushed in to Kettering General at just about 9:05 or thereabouts in the evening. So actually, Martin, from about 6 hours from the phone call, 6-7 hours from the phone call from the doctor, I was on life support.
Wow.
What happened was I was taken into A&E, and they started asking Margaret all sorts of questions like, you know, have you been on a foreign holiday? Has he eaten anything? Nowadays, you know, well, lots of people will know if it's sepsis, could it be sepsis? And that's it, opens all doors. But then it wasn't as well known.
Yes.
Even now it's not well known for lots of people, but back then it wasn't at all. 2 hours later, I was admitted to ICU with sepsis, and I was put into an induced coma. They tried to get hold of my two boys. One of my lads was in Shropshire somewhere. They couldn't get hold of him. But my other son lived in Kettering. And he said at 3 o'clock in the morning, he got a knock on his door, and it was the police. And I said, you need to get to hospital right away. Your dad's critically ill. So he got to the hospital. And when he got there, the consultant took Margaret and Liam aside and said, look, David is critically ill. He's probably the illest person in this hospital tonight and the one least likely to survive. And that was it. So it just, several years later, it still gets you, Martin, you know?
Yeah, I can see.
But anyway, I was in this induced coma for 3 weeks. And during that time, Margaret watched my feet turning black, my legs turning black, and my fingers turning black. And I don't know what's going through Margaret's mind looking at that. But on the second day that I was in hospital, you know, if it wasn't bad enough the first day, the second day I was in hospital, my condition deteriorated even further. And I went into what's known as septic shock and multi-organ failure. So my organs were closing down. That's when the consultant says to Margaret, and my two boys were there, their partners were there, he said, look, there's only a slim chance, a very, very slim chance of David making it at all. Over a year later, I think, once I could walk, I went up to ICU to see people in there. And the sister who was on that night showed me around and introduced me to people and took me to the room I was in, although there was somebody else in there then being treated. And she says, you know, David, we were fighting to save your life, but nobody, not one person on the team expected you to live. And, you know, when you hear something like that,
yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
That your life was almost snuffed out, just like that. And all it was started with a sore throat. I thought I had the flu, and then very quickly it grew into something worse. It was sepsis. They brought me out of the coma after 3 weeks, and I could see my left foot sticking out the covers, and it was black. And I looked down the bed, and I could see all the fingers on my left hand were black. I couldn't see the right side, and of course, I couldn't move. I couldn't move my arms. I actually thought I was strapped to the bed. I could not lift my arms. I couldn't feel my legs or move them. All I could do was move my head from side to side, and I couldn't speak. There was nothing coming out. You know, I'm just thinking, I must be paralyzed. I can't speak at all. And then the consultant, I started to listen to him because he was talking to me, and I couldn't really hear him, Martin. All this stuff was going through my mind. And then he said, look, he said, you've got a tracheostomy, so it's a tube going into your throat to help you to breathe. He says, unfortunately, it means that you can't speak at the moment. He says, but that will rectify, you know, when you're ready, we'll take that out and you'll be able to speak again. Don't worry about it. It was the worst time I'd ever had, Martin. And that night, it was the worst night ever. I was awake. I knew that my legs were going to come off. They weren't sure what's going to happen with my fingers.
Yeah.
They hoped that the fingertips would self-amputate. But at that stage, they weren't exactly sure. And I couldn't sleep. I thought to myself, you know, I've been in a coma for 3 weeks. How am I going to sleep now? And I started going hot and cold, pulling my head from side to side. I was in a terrible state, Martin. And the hospital in the evening do what all hospitals do. The ward kind of quietens down. Well, I was in a room, but ICU is quiet, but it's quite a busy place.
Mm.
And the lights are dimmed. And I was struggling. I was on my own. I just wanted Margaret and the boys there. Anyway, the doctor and the nurse came in because they're still monitoring you, even though they're not in the room. They can see on their monitors. And the doctor saying, everything's fine, David, you're going to be absolutely fine. It's no problem. And of course, I couldn't communicate with him. I couldn't tell him I was struggling with this breathing. Anyway, the nurse came back to me and she says, David, try and be still. And I knew that was important, Martin. I knew being still was really important. So all night, I'm trying to be still. And all that could come out in my mind was, please, God, help me. God, help me, please. It was like a loop that kept going on and on. And every now and again, I said, be still, try and be still. And there was a moment, I don't know where it was during the night, but there was a moment, I just knew everyone was going to be okay. You know these little drops you get for putting in your ears and you squeeze the end and there's a little drop comes out. It was like that. It was like a little drop, just a millisecond. And I thought, yeah, it's going to be okay. And when I thought about that later on, I thought, how can that be okay? How am I going to walk again? There are some people in here that have already looked at me and they don't really think from their faces, I'm going to walk again. So anyway, I had my left leg off in the May, so I was taken in on April the 8th. Had my left leg amputated on May 17th, I think it was.
Sorry to interrupt. When you're in the coma, are you able to dream? Can you remember anything of it? I know nothing on that subject.
Well, that's an interesting point, Martin. It's been asked of me several times, and I used to write down my dreams when I was out of the coma and I started to think about things. I started to write things down. Now, I worked with a psychologist for a year because working with the drug and alcohol charity, they worked with counsellors and psychologists. And my boss said to me, David, do you think you need help? After suddenly this happening, waking up, your legs are going to come off. It's quite a shock. And without hesitation, I said, yeah, I need help. For me to say that was quite something, Martin, because you were a trainer, I was the coach, I was the mentor. And although you were listening to people, lots of it was coming from you as well to help people along. And here's me saying, I need help. Now, I could have talked to Margaret. Margaret's a nurse. She's a registered general nurse. She's also a registered psychiatric nurse. Margaret had enough burdens, Martin.
Yes.
So anyway, I agreed to see this psychologist. And the first time I met her, she came up to the hospital. I was in my wheelchair. And she wheeled me in. It was at the back of the chaplaincy. And there's this really charming lady sitting opposite me. And she said, oh, David, it's really good to see you. I'm glad you could come along. And I started crying. I couldn't stop, Martin. I was sobbing. And it was really, really sobbing. Now, when I worked with this psychologist in Boston in the States, we used to write material together. And one of the things that was written, and he wrote this, he wrote about listening, and it was listening beyond words. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary. Listening beyond words. And when I first heard him say that, I thought, woohoo, that's a wee bit out there, you know. But when I had got myself together, when I was sitting with the psychologist, she said to me, it sounds like you've been through a terrible ordeal, David. It really sounds like you've been through a terrible ordeal. And I just thought to myself, after I'd met her and I was back in the ward, that was it. She was listening beyond any words because I never said anything. She just sensed everything that was coming out of me, that this was something really awful. So I started working with her. She'd come to the hospital once a week and then once a fortnight, and then when I was out of hospital, she came to the house. When I was able to drive again, I drove to her surgery. You know, I really benefited from that. I didn't think I would, but I did. Now, you asked about dreams. She asked me the same question. Was there anything you were dreaming about? And there was lots of things that I used to write down, and I don't know where these are, but there was two that really stood out in my mind. The one that was really extraordinary was I saw myself in this like an oldie worldy house.
And this was when you were in your coma?
Yeah. And there was a table and there was lots of people sitting around the table eating, and there was kids on the floor playing, laughing, joking. It was like an oldie worldy fireplace there. And I could hear them saying Sudborough. And I thought, this was it Mr. Sudbury? Well, I can't remember if it was Mr. Sudbury or Sudbury. Anyway, there was another door to the left of where I was looking at this table. There was a door to the left, and I could see people going through this door. There was like a little humpback bridge. They walked over, you know, and walked away. And the next thing, when I looked up, there was a panoramic window. The table had gone. There was a panoramic window in front of me, and I was drawn towards it. And as I was drawn towards it, it was like a meadow, and the long grass was just waving about slowly. And I could feel this breeze, and it was so refreshing. You know, it was wonderful. And there was hills in the background, not hills that you needed a mountaineering pack. It was hills you could walk up.
Yes.
And there was a little black car on one of the hills. And automatically, I thought, oh, that's my granddad's car. He used to have a Morris 8. There's nothing else came into my mind about that. So I was drawn further and further to this meadow. I was getting near it, and I thought, this is lovely. And it just disappeared. It just disappeared altogether. It was an extraordinary thing that happened, Martin. Really was. It just stuck in my mind, you know. And if people ask me about the dreams, there's another one that I can't, it's disappearing from my memory as well at the moment. But that's the predominant one. And when I got out of hospital, I was telling Margaret about this Sudbury. And actually, there's a Sudbury quite near Kettering.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove up to Sudbury. We drove round the place. It's obviously you drive in and you drive back out, really. And all the houses, well, most of them I seen backed onto fields, you know. And I thought, I wonder, you know, if I knocked on some of these doors, would there be a big window in here somewhere? But we never did. But we drove to Sudbury quite a few times. Maybe trying to jolt my memory or something, but it never really happened, Martin, no. But that's the one that sticks out in my mind, the dream.
Well, it's interesting that you can actually dream whilst in a coma.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you had great help from the psychologist saying, I'm listening, even though you haven't said anything, I'm listening and get it, which is what you need to have.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I want to throw in the God card now, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Where was your faith before you started the sepsis? And then where was your faith through all this time?
At that time, I was going to church. Margaret and I were going to church. There's a Pentecostal church in Corby. I was in the worship band. I was playing drums in the worship band. When this happened, it was, Margaret said, it was a big, big shock to the church. And people prayed. They talked about being in relays to pray for Dave, you know. It was quite something that I lived, and it was an answer to prayer for them. When I went back to church, it was extraordinary, Martin. I was wheeled in. I don't know how many, there was about 200 or 300 people. It was a big church. They were standing on their feet applauding when I went in. It was like a star had appeared, you know. I was overwhelmed by it.
Daley Thompson on the
Yeah. After the service had finished, there's people wanting to come up and give me a hug, grab me by the hand. And, of course, the pastor had said to me, I said to him, look, I'm nervous about coming back to church.
Yeah.
He said, well, look, wait till everybody's in and then come into church. You don't have to see people. And that's what I did. And, of course, all this happened. And he said, before it finishes, just go. You know, people understand. I couldn't get out the door, Martin. There's people stopping, hugging me. And it was an extraordinary time.
What was the time difference between when you last played and then went back to church?
Maybe 6, 7, 8 months, maybe something like that.
Right.
It was a while. I mean, I got on my legs quite quickly, really. After 5 months or 5, 6 months, I was walking.
Wow.
So it was maybe a couple of months after that. And it all came about getting to play again was through a friend, or we know Terrell Bryant.
Mm-hmm.
Terrell is a well-known drummer.
Brilliant drummer.
And we became friends. I went on a workshop near Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know, he comes from a Northamptonshire area, and he knew a lot of the guys I'd played in other worship bands. So he had kept in touch when he had heard about what happened, and he had sent a box set of drumming music through, and I listened to Drums of Hope. There's a track on it, Drums of Hope. I used to listen to this all the time, Mark. Gerald phoned me up and he had a chat and he says, what about playing again, Dave? I says, you know, I don't know how I'm going to manage, really. And he says, well, I'll get somebody to call you and talk it through. So this guy phoned me. He was a drummer, but he was also a design consultant. And actually, a few years ago, he was one of the directors of the British Drum Company.
Ah.
He said to me, the first question, this was on the phone, I was worried about the kick drum, you know, my right foot. How's this going to work? The first question he asked me was, what are you going to sit on, Dave? And I thought, well, I've got a drum stool. He says, one of these with the three legs on it.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. He says, no, you're going to fall off that, mate. And I thought, he's right.
Yeah.
I won't be able to sit on this stool and move my legs. I'll be all over the place. That was the first thing I did. I bought a four-legged drum stool, the big seat. And then he talked me through with the pedal. And he actually adapted a pedal. It was an old Speed King pedal, I think it was, and mm-hmm. he adapted it. Instead of chains and cables, it was all direct drive, so it was all metal. And so when you touched it, it really moved, it really moved. But I just had to practice with this. So he was so helpful, the guy. After that, I had to practice, because you suddenly realise how much you've got in your lower leg and your ankles and your foot. And when you're playing, you don't notice.
Yeah, yeah.
My leg just went up and down like a piston. I was practicing triplets with this. And if we played a fast tune, my roundabout, my stomach was aching. It was really sore. Anyway, I got back playing. I was enjoying playing, to the fact that I even went back and found a coach to take me through rudiments again. And
yeah, yeah.
I was thoroughly enjoying playing. But then we left that church, setting up the drums, packing the car. Martin, it was, you know, in the travel in, it was awful.
Yes.
So there was a church just round the corner from us. We had gone down there and they had an electronic kit all set up. So it was just round the corner, 2 minutes, round there. And after going a few weeks, this guy said to me, he's a sort of band leader, he said, hey, you play drums, Dave. He said, do you want to come down for a practice? I said, I don't think I will. I'm not. You know, he said, oh, come on down. So went down one night, got behind this kit. It was so easy to play, Martin. It was incredible. And I bought a pedal with no beater on it. It was just when you push the plate down, it just connected with a trigger.
Yes.
And the hi-hat was the same. And all the drum heads were close together and the cymbals were close together. Because apart from learning to play again, you know, like this, sometimes drummers, and I used to do it, maybe you're playing and your head's to the side, you know, you're listening to something.
Yeah, yeah.
What I noticed was when I was playing and I did a sort of fill, I missed the cymbal or I missed the drum.
Yes.
I thought, this is crazy, this. Anyway, I was talking to the psychologist about this. She said, there's something called proprioception, Dave, and that's because you've had so much amputation, you don't understand the distance now between you and, like, the target area. For example, it's easier to explain walking. I can see the road so I can walk, but at night I lift my feet a bit higher off the ground because I'm not sure where the road is.
Yeah, yeah.
She said, well, you're going to have to play your drums for a while using your eyes. You know, you're going to have to look, and see where you're playing. And that's how I had to do. And I had a hand therapist as well because my hands were in a bit of a state. She was great, you know, manipulating your hands. And we talked to her about playing the drums. And she says to me, how do you feel the sticks? And I thought, how do I feel it? I'd never thought about it, Martin. Never thought about it. Now, when you're playing a fast roll on the drums, you use your middle fingers
yep.
to flick up and down, and it balances on the stick. And when I looked at myself doing that, it wasn't happening. You know, my fingers weren't connecting with the drumstick properly. So I had to really practice at that as well. You know, just move my fingers a wee bit more. So it was quite a task getting back playing, but I absolutely loved it. And when we moved to this other church, this electronic kit, once we got the heads fixed out and into the brain to get the sounds right, it was lovely. That's where I was before and after. Yeah.
Wow. Would it be fair to say that your faith was ever in doubt? God, why is this fair? Why have I got this? I've been in a coma. I've done all this for you in the past. I've done this, I've done that.
Yeah.
And now I'm in a coma. What were those kind of thoughts like for you?
It was never in any doubt, Martin. I never, ever, never, ever said, why me? What have you done here, God? It was never his fault. It was never in my mind at all. Why me? What came into my mind was, how do I move forward from this?
Yeah.
I think if my energy was somewhere else, it wouldn't have worked. But my energy was on, what's next? How am I going to move forward? You know, really drink in this new situation I find myself in and find my way around. At that stage, my faith wasn't in doubt whatsoever.
Brilliant. So we've gone from 2013.
Yeah.
I mean, we still haven't talked about myeloma very quickly. How did that happen?
2020, I had a pain in the chest when I was breathing. And I thought right away, oh my goodness, could be a chest infection. We know that can lead to sepsis. So Margaret said, let's get up to A&E. I had a chest x-ray and the guy said, well, you've cracked a rib, David. And I thought, okay, fair enough. He said, no, just take some paracetamol, rest, you know, you'll be fine. The old adage. And I thought, how did I crack a rib? What was happening? A couple of weeks later, Margaret and I are down the town and we're having a walk and I became really breathless. I was really struggling. And I thought, oh, maybe this rib has punctured my lung or something.
Yes.
And so Margaret says, right, back up to A&E. And back up to A&E. And this doctor did various tests and he said, well, David, I really don't know what's going on. It could be heart failure, but I'm not sure. But he had a great character strength, Martin. He was curious.
Yeah.
He said, come in tomorrow. Come in tomorrow morning. I'll give you a CT scan and we'll find out what this is all about. When I was sitting in the waiting room, it's a packed waiting room. I don't know if I've told you this. My phone went and I couldn't get up. I can't get out of a chair quickly. I had to take the phone call there and then. It was my GP. And he says, David, we've been looking at these chest x-rays you had done a couple of weeks ago. I'd like you to come in to the surgery. We want to put you on a program for suspected lung cancer. And I thought, couldn't believe it. I said, well, this is where I am right now. He says, well, mention this when you go in the term to be looked at. So when I went in, it was 9 o'clock. Waiting room was absolutely packed. We went in, into this cubicle, and I told this to this nurse. So he went away, came back with a doctor, explained it to him. We got out of there about 4 in the afternoon, Martin. I had a chest x-ray, another chest x-ray, I had a CT scan, I had a urine test, I had 2 blood tests, I had any other test you can think of, I had. And at the end of the day, at 4 o'clock, there was not a soul left in the waiting room. And the nurses were all writing up. Silence. Went into this room. I sat down with Margaret at one end and the consultant said, oh, could you sit up here with me, David? And the doctor will sit with Margaret. So I'm fine. So I sat beside the consultant. He said, you know, there's some things in my job that are really good, David. This isn't one of them, afraid. The tests we've done so far, there's 2 other tests, but we believe you have what's known as multiple myeloma. And I was just about to say, what's myeloma? And he said, it's a type of blood cancer. It starts in the bone marrow, into the plasma where the white blood cells are, but that plasma is cancerous and it travels through your body and it rests in certain places. And it's you have extensive bone damage in your rib cage and your pelvic area. And he says, you definitely have multiple myeloma, this blood cancer. He says, but look, it's incurable, but it can be treated. And so I started treatment. It was chemotherapy. You would expect chemotherapy and other drugs to help me to ward off infections, and because it affects your immune system very quickly, this. The sort of gold standard at the time was to have a stem cell transplant. It's like resetting everything. They take your own stem cells. So I went in and they're what they call, they harvest them from you. And I had enough for a transplant, which was good. I think it was about 18 months ago, something like that. In August, I had a stem cell transplant. Lots of people had gone in, been in 2 weeks, everything was fine. I was in a month. It's high-dose chemotherapy, which knocks you for 6. I was really ill, lost all my hair. I lost sense of taste, smell. It was just an awful time. And of course, trust me, I developed what's known as neutropenic sepsis, which is absolutely deadly. That's when your white blood cells are wiped out altogether. I didn't realise how bad this was, apart from people saying to me, the nurses, you know, you gave us a real scare, David. But Margaret had said to the consultant, I said to Margaret, look, when it was at its height, when I was really poorly, the consultant says, look, is it okay to call you during the night? And Margaret thought, this is bad. I was in for 4 weeks and then out. Since then, Martin, I've been in remission. But I have a blood test every 2 weeks, 2 months, sorry. They measure the proteins in the blood. And once it gets over a certain point, they need to start the treatment again. But in the meantime, I'm on a maintenance dose of chemotherapy. That's part of the treatment. It's a fairly rare thing, really. There's maybe about 24,000 people in the UK at any one time have got it. 6,000 or so people a year die because of it. But it is incurable, and long may the stem cell transplant keep doing its work, you know. But it does go for the bones, and it's always something, you know, I say to my consultant, maybe get an X-ray, check my thigh bones and all of that are okay, because if it went to these parts, I would be struggling to walk about.
You see, stem cell being gold standard a couple of years ago, is that going to be the next big thing?
Yeah.
We heard loads of horror stories as to where the stem cells came from. What's your understanding where your stem cells came from?
They came from me. When they were going back in, they were like little black dots, like tiny dots. And the nurse would say, look, that's them going in now, David.
Yeah.
Now, that's the stem cells you had when you were born. And I thought, wow. And some people say I'm celebrating my first rebirthday, you know, on the day they got the transplant.
Yeah.
So they came from me.
Yes.
But if it didn't work, they could take them from someone else. They could take them from Margaret or whatever. I don't know if they have to be a match or whatever, yes. But they're very, very careful about things like that now. Yeah. But these came from me. Yeah.
Brilliant. Wow, Dave. This is the first time I've seen you since 1993.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow, is it really? Goodness.
My life has been somewhat different to yours.
Yeah.
And we're still here. It's incredible what you've been sharing.
Mm.
And yet your faith is still here, which is even more amazing.
Yep. Faith is still here and still want to raise awareness. You know, we'll talk at conferences or...
Yeah.
It's been quite busy that way at times, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, all I can say to you, Dave, is firstly, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. And secondly,
yeah.
Who is your Christian hero, please?
Well, that's a good one, Martin. And when I read it, is a Christian hero, not in the Bible.
Correct.
And dead.
Correct.
Not in the Bible. I couldn't get it, Martin. I couldn't get it. I could maybe go Google people and see, but I don't know anything about them. So I hope I'll let this one go with me, Martin, because I do have a hero, and it's Doubting Thomas.
No, I'll let you have that. I know it's not in the Bible, but do you know what? Every so often, it's good to think outside the proverbial box.
Yeah.
Doubting Thomas, tell me why.
Well, he has this strength that he's curious.
Mm.
And that's all through my illnesses. I've met somebody, a consultant, who's curious. They want to find out more. So it's a big deal. And when I look at Doubting Thomas, I thought, he's got that. He's curious. And I always wonder about the conversations they had with the rest of the disciples.
Yeah.
Because Jesus, after resurrection, appeared to Mary Magdalene. Then he appeared to maybe two disciples and then maybe five disciples. But Thomas, well, if I can't see it, I will never believe. And that was what he said. And I always wonder about the conversations that were going on. Because the 11 disciples that were there were in this room, and then Jesus appeared. Now, for me, that would have been it.
Yes.
Jesus, he has appeared. Wow, that's it. Fine. But not Thomas. Thomas wanted to look and see what had happened to Jesus. And Jesus showed him the wounds. Mm-hmm. And there's nowhere I can read that he actually touched anything, but he could see them for himself. And that was it. It must have filled this guy fully, mentally, physically, with this fact that Jesus, blimey, he's resurrected. He's here. And I often think about that when he went into the mission field, which was mainly in India.
Yeah.
Sadly, he was martyred there. That experience that he had from a real state of unbelief to a very, very strong belief.
Yes.
I've seen it for myself. That must have been so powerful when he was talking to people. The doubt that he had was strong, but then it disappeared. It disappeared after his curiosity was satisfied. And I think that, for me, that's a hero.
Definitely. And the fact that they shouldn't use the word doubting at all, because it was just his learning style. And I get that. That's the thing. It was his learning style.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right there, Martin. Yeah, absolutely right.
If only I used to train on that all those years ago. I'll wait a minute. Dave Carson, thank you so much for joining us today. And I really do hope that we can meet up again soon and go for another prayer walk. That'd be amazing.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you for joining us today.